So today, we have Olivier Landon Carnell from Sherbrooke speaking.
Yes. All right, so today I'm going to be talking about a Google result about self-correcting topological memories in 2D. So this is a joint work with my graduate David Poulin at the University of Sherbrooke, and so we're part of this new quantum group at Sherbrooke, which we call EPIC. Well, it's in French, but it's just the Physics of Quantum Information Group. And that's a cool name, so pick that. So before I do that, I just want to give you a brief overview about what I've done during my PhD, in case anybody's interested in other stuff that I've done. So I've spent some time looking at practical characterization of quantum systems. I'm actually going to give a talk, an informal talk at IQC tomorrow at 1 about this. So the idea there is to try to somehow extract information about an experimental quantum system and try to do it in a scalable way. So of course you can always do quantum state tomography, but that's very expensive. And so we'll look at ways, scalable ways to try to extract information about an experimental system. So one thing we developed that we call certification. So suppose you have some target state that you want to prepare, and you prepare something in a lab that's your experimental state, and you want to compare the distance between the two to show that indeed they are close. So there's a way to do that based on a Monte Carlo approach that is very efficient for certain class of states and that always does better than tomography. So we presented that in that paper, and that was actually used in ETH Zurich to certify Toffoli gates on superconducting qubits. Another approach we developed was to try to do what we call variational tomography. So instead of looking for recursive circuit a state inside a full Hilbert space, we only restrict ourselves to some variational class of states. And the idea there is that those states are described by a small number of coefficients. So is it possible by a small number of experiments to directly access those parameters? And we've shown how to do that for matrix product states, and we've extended those results to MERA. So this is quite different from what I'm going to talk about. Today I'm going to talk about self-correction in 2D. So what we want to do is build a self-correcting memory. Okay, so think of a hard drive. We have hard drives in our classical computers. We'd like to have something similar for a quantum computer. So when you turn off your laptop, I mean, the information stays there. And so that's more or less the idea about the self-correcting memory. So first and foremost, it's a physical system onto which you're going to encode some information. And in our case, that's going to be some quantum information. And there's a few desiderata that you want for this memory. You want the encoding to be reliable. You want the information to stay there for a macroscopic period of time, so for a long time. You're going to let the memory interact with its environment, usually a thermal environment, so there's going to be some noise affecting your memory. And you don't want to do any active error correction. Okay, so we're not in the usual quantum error correcting paradigm where you spend a lot of efforts trying to measure syndromes and then applying corrections. We're in the setup where you first encode, and then you let the environment act with some noise model. And eventually, after a long time, at the very end, you might do one step of decoding to actually recover the information. Okay, so this is more or less what I mean by self-correcting as opposed to an active quantum error correcting code. So okay, by the way, I should have started with this. If you have any questions, feel free to interrupt whenever. I'd rather like make it clear than just go through all this slide and nobody understands anything. So we have this self-correcting memory. And throughout the rest of the talk, whenever I talk about a code, what I mean is the degenerate ground space of a local Hamiltonian of spin particles, of qubits, on a 2D lattice. Okay, so all this talk is going to be about 2D, except when I mention otherwise that I'm talking about something in 3D or 1D. Okay, otherwise it's all 2D. So let's look at the way this is done classically, a self-correcting classical memory. So one nice example to think of is the 2D ferromagnetic Ising model. So you have a 2D regular lattice, and you put a ferromagnetic interaction sigma z between nearest neighbors. And in that case, you have a twofold degenerate ground space that which is spanned by the all upstate and the all downstate. So
this is going to be, let's say, your logical zero and your logical one. So let's say you want to encode classical information, you want to put a zero in, you prepare the memory in the all up state. And now you want to know, is it thermally stable? If I let this Ising model interact with a local environment, is the information going to remain? So when I prepare the all up state, eventually some spins are going to flip because of the interaction with the environment. And the question is, are they all going to flip, or is it just like some random clusters of spins that are going to flip? And what you can show is that for a temperature that is below some threshold temperature, namely the Curie temperature, there's not a macroscopic error droplet that's going to appear. So there's going to be few scattered spins that have flipped, but globally they're all going to be in the up state. So it's still possible to recover your logical zero. And this is very different from what would happen in the 1D case. In the 1D case, suppose now I'm on a chain. Again, I have a ferromagnetic chain, so I have the all up state and all down state. If I were to initially prepare the all up state, it would be possible for the environment to, let's say, flip a few spins. So there's some energy associated to the fact there's some domain wall. But afterwards, it would be possible to flip the next spin, move the domain wall. There's no energy penalty associated to that process. And progressively, you could flip all the spins in the chain and go from the all up state, your logical zero, to the all down state, your logical one. Okay? So in that sense, the 1D chain, the 1D ferromagnetic Ising model wouldn't be stable, whereas the 2D one is thermally stable if you're below some critical temperature. So this is true for the perfect model, like you have exactly this interaction. However, if you put a perturbation, this 2D Ising model is not stable. If you put a small magnetic field, you can favor, let's say, the all down state compared to the all up state. So you're splitting the degeneracy of your model. And then what's going to happen if you start from the all up state, progressively spins are going to flip, and eventually it's going to spread to the entire lattice, and you will go to the one state, which is now more favorable energetically. And so this is true for any system which has a local order parameter, because it's possible for the environment to couple to this local order parameter and to split the degeneracy of your ground space. So what we would like to have is a quantum system which has no local order parameter, and more generally, that has a stable spectrum. So essentially, we're looking for a system which there's a degenerate ground space, there's a gap, which is usually constant, and then you have the first excited states. And we want a system, whenever there's a perturbation, we don't want this gap to close, and we don't want the degeneracy of the ground space to lift by more than, let's say, an exponentially small amount, okay? And so we know of such systems as those are topologically ordered systems that have this property. So let me briefly discuss the archetypical example of a topological system, at least in our community, as the Kitaev story code. So many of you are probably familiar with this. So you start with this lattice, you put spin 1/2 or qubits on the edges. So whenever there's a small dot, that means there's a qubit of spin 1/2 living on it. And you're going to impose periodic boundary conditions so that you end up on a torus. And now you're going to define two family of operators. Whenever you have a vertex like this, you're going to define a star operators, which is a four-body Pauli and sigma x interaction between the four neighboring sites to the four neighboring qubits to that vertex. And you can define something similar whenever you have a plaquette. You're going to define a four-body Pauli Z interaction between the four neighboring sites of the plaquette. And now you can check that those, whenever you have a star operator and a plaquette operator, they commute with one another. If they're far away, they trivially commute. And if they're close to one another, there's going to be one first anti-commutation between an X and a Z, and always a second anti-commutation between an X and a Z. So globally, those operators are going to commute. And so now, if you look at the Hamiltonian, which is minus the sum over all sites of star operators, minus the sum over all plaquettes of plaquette operators, if you're going to have a four-fold degenerate ground space on the torus, so you can encode two logical qubits in that memory. And furthermore, you can show that whenever there's a small perturbation, this model is spectrally stable. So it won't collapse the gap, and it won't lift the degeneracy of the ground space. So now a question would be, OK, we have this nice property, stable spectrum. Is this model thermally stable? Is it possible for a thermal environment to come and destroy the information? So to look at that, you need to look at the structure of excitations inside that model. So let's say you start from one ground state, which is a plus one eigenstate of all star operators and Plaquette operators. And now you want to know if it's possible for a thermal environment to go from that ground state to another orthogonal ground state. And to know that, you have to look at the structure of logical operators. So logical operators are operators that map one ground state to a different ground state. So in the case of the Turing code, one example of such an operator is a string of Z that wraps around the torus, which makes a non-trivial loop around the torus. For instance, this one. Okay, if the environment is capable of applying this operation, it will map one ground state to a different ground state, so that would corrupt the information that you encoded initially in the Turing code. So is it possible somehow for the environment that only can act locally to apply this long string operator that wraps around the torus, which is very non-local? So what the environment could do is just create excitations. And we're going to be interested in how much energy the environment needs to put in the system to be able to apply this logical operator. So namely, if the environment can apply through a sequence of a local move this string of Z operators by only putting in a constant amount of energy into the system, we're going to say that the memory is unstable. And if to apply this logical operator, the environment has to go through an energy barrier that scales with system size, we're going to say that the memory is stable. So let's look at what happens in the Turing code. The environment comes, apply a Z error on one qubit. This Z anti-commutes with the two neighboring star operators. So in your Hamiltonian, you have two terms that are violated. So you have some energy that is associated to the endpoints of this string. So if you look at the energy meter here, you've created you've put in some energy in your system. And now the environment might come, apply another Pauli Z. Again, this anti-commutes with this star operator. So you have some energy here. But if you look at this star operator, it anti-commutes with the Z on the left, anti-commutes with the Z on the right. So there's no energy associated to it. Okay. So I've gone from one Pauli Z to two Pauli Zs. And if you look at the amount of energy in the system, it doesn't change. Okay. In more condensed matter terms, you have two quasi-particles that are associated to the endpoints of this string. And you can move them around without paying any energy. Okay. So, and eventually, if those anions wrap around the torus and fuse back to the vacuum, you've gone from one ground state to a different ground state. So this process is possible in the Turing code, or more generally, you could have pairs of anions appearing and then fusing together, and eventually that's going to wrap around the torus. And so it's possible for a thermal environment to create those thermal excitation, pay a very small amount of energy that doesn't scale with system size, and totally corrupt the information inside the Turing code. Okay? So in that sense, the Turing code is not a thermally stable memory. So up till now, what do we have? We have the 2D Ising model, which is thermally stable, but doesn't have a stable spectrum. And we have the Turing code, which has a stable spectrum under perturbation in the Hamiltonian, but is not thermally stable. So what we would like to know is it possible to combine those two properties, to have something that is both thermally stable and has a stable spectrum. And what we're going to show is that there's a no-go result about that. So during the rest of the talk, I'm going to first describe more precisely in what setup I'm stating my result. So we're going to introduce this class of codes, defined by what I mean by topological order, by self-correction, and briefly review the known results in the literature about that. And afterwards, I'm going to state the main result and give you some elements of the proof of our result. So we don't want to say anything that's specific about like one Hamiltonian, so we're going to look at a broad class of systems. So we're going to look at n finite dimensional spins that are on a 2D lattice. Okay, so you have n qubits on a 2D lattice, and you're going to define your Hamiltonian to have this form. So it's minus the sum of a family of operators. Okay, and now we're going to put some constraint on those operators. So each term has bounded strength. Okay, so we're not cheating by putting some like incredible amount of energy into one term of that Hamiltonian. All the terms commute. Okay, so that's something that we're used to from quantum error correction. If you want to do syndrome measurement at the very last step of quantum error correction, that's probably a property that you want. All terms are local. They only act on a few particles that are close to one another in a geometrical sense on the 2D lattice. And finally, it's frustration-free in the sense that a ground state of the global Hamiltonian is also a ground state for each of the individual terms. Yeah. So this is the class of system we're looking at. And in this work, we're only interested in what happens with the ground state and the first excited states and the scaling of the energy. Okay, so without loss of generality, we're going to restrict those operators to be projectors. Okay, because essentially, I mean, a global ground state is a ground state for every term. So we're just going to look at essentially the projector onto the ground space of each of those more general logical operators. So at the end of the day, we're going to end up with what is known in the literature as those local commuting projector codes, or LCPCs. So it's a family of projectors that commute with one another. And a ground state of the Hamiltonian is a plus one eigenstate of each of the individual terms. Okay. So in particular, if you want to know what's the structure of the projector onto the code space, onto the ground space of this Hamiltonian, you just need to take the product of all the projectors that define the code. Yes?
So why do you want all the terms to commute? Is that something about error correction? But I mean, you could have said
earlier that you want to have active error correction. Yeah, so, OK. So I don't want to do active error correction, but eventually at the very end, when I want to recover the information inside my memory, I might do one step of error correction. So essentially, I want to be able to do like syndrome measurement at this last step, not throughout the process. And so there I might need this property to be able to do it.
But suppose you could, you know, get the stability that you want in a system without terms commuting. Would that be something good or useless? Or
Well, actually, we're going to show that under this assumption, like, you cannot have thermal stability in a topological memory. So yes, indeed, that's maybe one assumption that we need. Like, can we lift this assumption and have something better, that's definitely something we should look at. Okay, so we have those local commuting projector codes. And this looks similar to stabilizer codes, except for the fact that for stabilizer codes, you don't have general projectors. You have projectors that are somehow linked to tensor product of Pauli operators. Okay, whereas here, we don't put any restriction on, aside from the fact that there are local projectors that commute with one another. Okay, so for instance, Levenwen models fit into that framework and are not stabilizer codes. Okay, so this goes a little beyond stabilizer codes. Okay, so essentially this looks like this. You have a lattice, you have qubits everywhere, and each circle represents the support of one projector, and they all commute with one another, and you're encoding inside the ground space of this Hamiltonian. Okay. So this is what we're looking at, and one of the nice properties of those local commuting projector codes is that we know of a sufficient criterion to prove that they have a stable spectrum. Okay, so namely, Sergey Brevi, Matt Hastings, and Spiros Michalakis showed that if you have such a LCPC system, and furthermore, you have topological quantum order, then you know that for small enough perturbation, the gap of the system is not going to close, and the degeneracy of the ground space is not going to be lifted. Okay, so now I'm going to tell you exactly what I mean by this local topological quantum order criterion. So it splits into two criteria. The first one is very intuitive. The other one, not so much. So the first one tells you that you want to be locally indistinguishable, okay? Which means that a local operator, a local observable, cannot discriminate between different ground states, okay? Or in other words, there is no local order parameter, okay? Remember that a local order parameter in the case of 2D ferromagnetizing model was what prevented it from being stable under perturbation.
So it comes as no surprise that you want to eliminate that. So you don't want the environment to couple to that local order parameter. Second one is, I like to refer to it as local consistency. It means that if you look at a ground state locally, I'm going to define what it means to be a local ground state. A local ground state can always be extended to a global ground state. Okay, so it's always compatible with a global ground state. You cannot have something that locally looks like a ground state, but in fact globally is not. Okay, so more formally, this local indistinguishability means that whenever you have an observable or linear operator that acts in a small region that is topologically trivial, when you restrict its action to be inside the code, when you look at its action inside the code, it essentially acts like as multiplying by a constant. Okay, so it acts trivially inside the code. Now, this local consistency condition means that if you take a small region A, topologically trivial, and if you look at all projectors whose support overlap this region A, I can define a local projector onto the code, okay, by just taking the product of those projectors, not all the projectors defined in the code, but only the ones that touch this region A. Okay, this is a local version of the projector. And now I can look at this object, which is more or less a density matrix, by tracing out everything that is outside of A of this projector. Okay, so that's a maximally mixed state inside the code space, but for a local version of the code space. And now I want to compare it to the same thing, but taking the full projector, which is really the projector that projects onto the global code. And I'm going to see that those two are locally consistent if they have the same kernel. Okay, so up to normalization, those are density matrices. So you can diagonalize them. They have a bunch of non-zero eigenvalues and zero eigenvalues. The non-zero eigenvalues can be slightly different because there's less information here than here. However, the kernels must be exactly the same. Okay, so intuitively, that means that I can take this thing and extend it to be a global ground state. Okay, and under those two, if those two assumptions are satisfied, then an LCPC Hamiltonian is going to have a stable spectrum. Okay, so now I know what kind of systems I'm looking at. I'm going to assume that they have topological order to ensure that they have a stable spectrum. And now I need to know what I mean when I say that it is or not a self-correcting memory. Okay, and again, we don't want to say something specific about one system and one way that one system thermalizes. We want to say something that is independent of the model. So, and thermalization in general is something very complicated. Okay, so we're only going to keep like a cartoon version of thermalization by keeping two ingredients that come. That are common to most thermalization processes. Namely, we're going to penalize high energy states, okay, to mimic the Boltzmann constant or factor. And we're also only going to allow the environment to have local noise. So it can only do local moves or local CPTP maps when it acts on the memory. Okay, yes?
Stability and spectral stability are sort of different things. Mm-hmm. But now you're saying, well, you pick this local topological order conditions to ensure spectral stability, but do you actually care about spectral stability? I mean, if you had thermal stability.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so if you have
in some other way, then.
If the spectrum is not, okay, so first, I mean, for a realistic system, you're not going to have the perfect like model Hamiltonian. Going to have some Hamiltonian that probably is going to have some perturbation. If it's possible, well, so if the spectrum is not stable, for instance, if the gap closes, probably start from one ground state. If afterward the gap closes, you're going to be able to easily to access other ground states and to curb the information. Same thing if the ground states, if the ground space degeneracy splits. Probably it might be possible to favor some ground states energetically compared to the others. So in that sense, that's where you want to have a stable spectrum.
But did you say in the classical Ising model, there's no spectral stability?
Yeah, so the classical Ising model is thermally stable for the perfect model, but as soon as you put a perturbation, okay, so it's a combination of the two. If you split the degeneracy of the ground space, for instance, some ground states are going to be favored energetically. So as soon as a thermal environment is going to come in, it's going to prefer that state compared to the others. So there you might lose the encoded information. So that's why we're asking for a stable spectrum in our model. And furthermore, we also want it to be thermally stable. So those are two different notions.
So are there classical models that are both spectrally stable?
Yes. To store classical information, yes. But like cellular automaton, like this kind of stuff, or Tom's rules for 2D. Okay, so in this model, so we want to know, like, so this is a very simplified model, and so essentially what we want to know
is it possible for a thermal environment to go from one ground state to a different ground state? Okay, so again, this goes back to looking at the structure of logical operators, which are operators that take you from one ground state to another ground state. And so we're related to that model that asks, is it possible for the environment to apply a sequence of local move, of CPTP maps, that implement this logical operator? Is that possible? Okay. And that corresponds to this criterion. And furthermore, we want to know, is it possible to apply the sequence of local move without creating too much energy in the system? Okay. Do we need to go through an energy barrier that scales with system size? Or is it possible by only putting in a constant amount of energy to go from one ground state, initial ground state, to a different ground state eventually? Okay, so I'm going to bring back this energy meter. Now I have the sequence of local move, okay, that interpolate between this ground state and this different ground state. And so starting from energy zero, you're going to put in some energy and eventually going to come back to the ground, to the ground space. So doing that, you put in some energy up till here, and then you go back. Okay. And so what I'm interested in, like, what's this energy barrier? What's the maximum energy of intermediate states that I need to go through to go from one ground state to another ground state? Okay. So this would be the energy barrier for a particular ground state, a particular encoded state, and for this particular sequence of local moves. And then you can take the minimum of that for any possible initial ground state, any possible sequence of local move. And now, if this minimal energy barrier of the code is something that is independent of system size, you're going to say that this is unstable. And if it's, or if on the other, if it's something that's scaled with system size, then given a finite temperature, it will always be possible to scale the system up so that those processes would be suppressed, okay. And in that case, you would have thermally stable self-correcting memory. Okay. So what we're going to show is that, importantly, we're in the case where this energy barrier can at most be a constant. Okay. So we get no protection by this kind of mechanism. Okay. So what's known in the literature? So Kitaya story code, this is unstable. And if you think about it, the key features to show that is that even though you're in a 2D code, the logical operator lives on a 1D structure. It is string-like. And furthermore, you're in a stabilizer code, so it's a tensor product of single body unitaries. Okay? So in that case, it's clear how the environment can come and gradually build this logical operator sequentially. Okay? So that showed that the Torrey code was unstable. And in fact, this is true for any 2D stabilizer code. So remember, everything here is 2D. And you can use a tool called a cleaning lemma to show that any logical operator for a 2D stabilizer code is going to be, well, there's always exist a string-like logical operator for a 2D stabilizer code, OK? And so then you can use the same kind of arguments to show that this is going to be unstable also. And now if you go to local commuting projector codes, you can extend this cleaning lemma to the disentangling lemma. And you can show, and that was done by Zhang Wenha and John Preskill, that indeed there always exists a logical operator that lives on a 1D strip inside this 2D lattice. Okay, so that remains true even beyond stabilizer code. However, you lose this property. This logical operator is not necessarily a tensor product of single by the unitaries. Okay, so it's not that clear how the environment would come and apply it sequentially by a sequence of local moves. Okay, but however, it's on a, it lives on a strip. It is supported on a strip. So essentially, what we've done is to look, to find a way to apply it through a sequence of local move, and to show that we can do that without creating too much energy, without going through an energy barrier that would scale with system size. Okay, so this is essentially our result. So as I said, I'll briefly state the result and then give you some elements of the proof. Okay. So result, if you give me any 2D local topologically ordered local commuting projector code, I can exhibit a physically realistic error model that's going to corrupt the information. Okay, and that that model is a sequence of local moves that do not go through an energy barrier. Okay, so let me briefly discuss that. So local topological order, we put that ingredient in because we know it's something that is sufficient to ensure spectral stability. Okay, and at the moment, at least as far as I know, that's the more general criterion available in the literature to ensure that. But what we show is that if you have this ingredient in, then you're thermally unstable. Okay, so apparently this seems to be kind of a trade-off between those two things. At least if you put local topological order in, you get this, but you don't get this. You don't get thermal stability, you get an instability. Okay, so there seems to be kind of a trade-off here, but we would like to understand better. Okay, so now let me go through the ideas of the proof. So as I said, a 2D local commuting projector codes look like this. Okay, you have qubits everywhere, you have projectors that commute that act on different set of qubits, and you know there exists a strip where there lives a logical operator. Okay, so this doesn't look so good, so let's coarse grain it, and we're going to end up with that thing. Okay, so here N, this thing, is the strip onto which I know there exists, the support of a logical operator is inside that strip. Okay, and now I'm going to coarse grain all the qubit inside the strip, so that I end up with those like qubits with a larger d that I'm going to call sites. So I'm going to have 1, 2, 3, 2L sites. Okay, and same thing with the projector. I can coarse grain them, so take product of those local projectors to define larger projectors. So projectors that are going to act on two sites of the strip, so site k minus 1 and site k, and potentially that act just outside of the strip. Okay, so now I have this kind of like 1D structure with like nearest neighbor interaction, okay, because each projector acts onto two sides of the strip. And yeah, so just to make clear, when I talk about the site, that means one of those coarse grained particles here. As I said, we have this kind of 2D, this kind of 1D nearest neighbor interaction. And we have those local constraints, okay? So those are the projectors here. So whenever they're going to be green, that means that the state I'm looking at is inside the image of all those projectors, okay? In other words, the local constraints are satisfied. And you see in the rest of the talk, sometimes those constraints are going to be red. That means that for sure they're not satisfied. And sometimes they're going to be orange, meaning that with some probably they're satisfied, and with some other probably they're not, okay? So this is the setup I'm going to look at. So is that clear? Okay. So now I'm going to introduce two noise models. Okay. The first one is going to be an auxiliary error model, very simple, and we need it for proof purposes. And then the second one is going to be the actually physically realistic model that the environment could apply to corrupt the information. So let's go with the first model, which we call the fortuitous model. So I start from a ground state. So all the local constraints are satisfied. Everything's green, everything's OK. And now I'm going to depolarize every site on the strip N. Okay, so I'm going to take the particles and replace that by maximum mixed state. Okay, so let's do that. I depolarize everybody. All the local constraints now are in orange. They're probably not satisfied. And I've created a lot of energy into my, I've put a lot of energy into my system, probably something that scales with the linear size of the system. And now I want to go back to the code. Okay, but remember, this is not physical in any way. So I'm just going to project back onto the code, okay, brutally. This is probably, like, the probability that this happens is probably very small, exponentially small. But again, this is not a physical model. I do whatever I want. So I'm just going to bam, go back to the code space. Okay? So this is an error model that creates a lot of energy, but that maps a code state from to another code state. Okay? And clearly it wipes out the information that was contained, that was supported on this chip, in the sense that I've replaced every side by the maximally mixed state at the beginning. So whatever was encoded there cannot survive this operation. Okay? But yes, it is very unphysical. I put in a lot of energy. And the projection that I'm doing at the end and post-selecting onto a projection that is very unlikely, hence the name fortuitous model. Okay? So now the idea is to try to turn that into something that would make physical sense. So first idea is that instead of depolarizing the full strip at the beginning, I could depolarize site one, and then depolarize site two, and then depolarize site three, and so on. I don't need to do them all at once. And same thing, when I do the projection, I can project on the local constraint of site one and two, two and three, and then so on. Okay? And better, I could interleave those two steps, and maybe somehow there's a way to interleave those steps so that I get something that has a high probability to succeed every iteration. Okay, so that's essentially the idea of our model. Okay, we're going to interleave those steps. That leads us to the iterative randomization model. Okay, so I'm going to spend some time on this. Okay, this is essentially like the model that we use to prove everything else. Okay, so if you have any question, if everything's not clear about that, please ask questions. So the idea is that for every site k, okay, that's going to define an iteration, I'm going to apply some random unitary. So I pick some unitary from the R measure, apply it on site k. And afterwards, I'm going to, so when I say I, what actually means like the environment would do that. Okay. So the environment would come and measure the local constraint. Okay. And so the idea is that this is essentially to mimic the fact that the environment wants to reduce the amount of energy in the system. Okay. So it's going to measure this local constraint. Probably is not going to be satisfied, this local constraint. So then the environment comes, apply another random unitary on site k, measure against the logical operator, and does that many times until at some point this local constraint is going to be satisfied. Okay? So suppose, again, I start from a ground state, so all local constraints are satisfied. I'm going to start and apply some random unitary on the first site. Okay? So probably now I've gone away from the ground space, I've created some excitation. In particular, this local constraint is probably not satisfied anymore. Okay? And now I'm going to do something, I'm going to apply something random on site two. Some random unitary. That again violates probably the next constraint. So I have some energy in the system. And now I'm going to look at the local constraint on site one and two, and I would like it to be satisfied. Okay, so I do the environment would do the measurement. Probably it's not going to be satisfied, so it's going to be in red. Okay, so again, there's going to be a lot of energy. Okay, so essentially, to give you an intuition why I want this to become green, I want to satisfy this local constraint, is that probably I've created some quasi-particle, some excitation here. And I want to move it to the right, okay? I want to take that excitation and bring it all the way across this strip and fuse it at the other extremity, on the other boundary here, okay? And if I manage to do that, probably I will have gone from one ground state to a different ground state, okay? So by acting on site two, I want to move this quasi-particle to the right, okay? So that didn't work the first time, at the first trial. So now I again apply something random on site two. Now this become orange. It's maybe there might be some probability that is satisfied, and I measure it, and at some point it's going to be satisfied. Okay. Once I've managed to do that, it means that my excitation does now move one step to the right. Okay. And now I want to continue doing this. So I'm going to apply something a random unitary on site three. That is going to disagree with the local constraint on site three and four, and now I'm going to look at the local constraints site two and three, okay? And I'm going to do that repeatedly until it works at site two, and then I'm going to move to the right, okay? And I want to do that to, like, sweep across the full strip and do something non-trivial on the code, okay? So that's the error model we're looking at, okay? So immediate properties of this, everything is local in that error model. At any step, there's at most two local constraints that are not satisfied. So the amount of energy is something that does not depend on system size. And furthermore, let's suppose here I'm doing something random on site 3. Since the projectors commute, I don't need to go back and do something on site 1 or site 2. Okay, I've dealt with those previously. So I only need to try to go forward. I don't need to backtrack and do something, and I might leave some energy. So, and that's linked to the fact that we have commuting constraints. Okay. However, what's there are many things to show. First, is it always possible to go forward? Okay. Suppose now I'm at site 3. Is it always possible to find a unitary that allows me to go forward in the sense that if I'm here at site 3, I want the local constraint of site 2 and 3 to be satisfied. Is that possible? What's the expected number of trials, expected number of unitaries I need to try before actually succeeding in that task? And we're going to show that this is a constant. And at the end, what are we doing to the code? Okay, is this just some sort of very crazy way to apply the identity, or are we actually doing something non-trivial to the code? Okay, and we're going to show that this model has the same average effect as the model before, where we just depolarize everything one shot and project back onto the code. All right, so any question about the model itself? Or yes? A unitary tool design would do the trick. I think so. Yeah. But again,
I mean, since we're trying to mimic what the environment would do, I don't know if the environment has any notion of what it means to do it, to design. But yeah. But I think for the purpose of the proof, I think that would be enough. Look at that. Yes?
So this iterative model seems to assume a certain time ordering of the noise, mm-hmm. which if we really have things happening at random, it's a fairly low probability event to have that time ordering.
Yeah.
To what extent it will affect how realistic the model is?
OK, so I agree with you that it would be much more convincing if it was something that was just like applying random unitaries everywhere at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so we're looking at this at the moment. So that's something we'd like to prove. We haven't been able to prove it yet. But in one way, it's similar to what happens in Tory code. I showed this a nice model where the environment would apply a sigma z error, and then a sigma z error next to it, and then a sigma z error next to it. So that's one way to corrupt the information inside the Tory code. Another way is to apply just random sigma z errors, and eventually there's going to be a path of sigma z errors that wraps around the torus. So we think, because of our intuition on the Tory code, that this should be also the case here.
But
we
the time ordering clearly doesn't matter.
Yeah, but OK, but here, I mean.
But will there be a different energy barrier if you do that sort of process, where you act everywhere?
If you act everywhere,
the
energy is not going to be exactly the same. But again, I mean, everything commutes here, so. I'm not sure that like the time ordering is that crucial because everything commutes, so you might be able to do everything at the same time.
But
yes.
But the thing you're trying to prove is for.
But this model, we're doing everything one after the other. Is that the question?
No, you said you were trying to prove something more general, where the noise.
Yes, where the noise would just act on like. Well, one first approximation would be take this model and apply just random unitaries on any site.
So what kind of energy barrier would you get from the argument?
In that case, probably, yeah. Well, OK. I don't want to get into the discussion of energy barrier, but I mean, if you have a density, probably in this kind of system, there's going to be an amount of energy that's maybe proportional to L squared. Okay, because you have, well, L squared, like the number of sites. Okay, if you have a constant density of energy, the approximation that you only have a constant amount of energy is probably not true. If you go back to the 2D Ising model, in general, like you would have L squared, like an energy that grows extensively to the system size. So you need to take entropy into account to make an argument that's more rigorous. So maybe, yeah, and we can come back to that at the end. All right, so we want to show these properties. First one. Fact that it's always possible to go forward.
So a deadline would be some step where I've prepared something that is compatible with all the local constraint, And yet it's impossible for me to find a unitary such as satisfy the constraint just to the left of this site. Okay? So I'll just give you an example that probably make everything clearer. Suppose you have a chain of Q-trits, okay? And you have, so Q-trits being three-level, like particles that have three possible states. And I have nearest neighbor interaction where those projectors tell me you can, like, those particles can be the 0-0 state, 1-1 state, or 2-2 state, okay? You have this everywhere on the chain, except at one point where you might have a defect or something. And here, you can be in the 0-0 state or in the 1-1 state, but you're not allowed to be in the 2-2 state. Okay, this is ruled out by this interaction. So if you look at the projector inside the code space, it's going to be spanned with the all 0 state and the all 1 state. Okay, the all 2 states is not a possibility. So suppose I have initially the all 0 state, and I launch my noise model on this, and it starts preparing the 2 state. Okay, that's one possibility. This is going to satisfy all the local constraints on the left. So it started preparing the 2 state. So I add 0 at the beginning, and I would put 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2. And once I arrive here, I try to apply a unitary here on the 0 state to satisfy this constraint that tells me it can be in the 0, 0 state or in the 1, 1 state. Okay? But I did prepare 2 here. So whatever unitary I apply here, it's not going to be possible for the Noi model to go forward, because there's no way it's going to, like, by definition, it cannot change the site that was just before. Okay? So in that case, you would get into a dead end. You've prepared a state compatible with all previous local constraints, but it's not possible to go forward afterwards. However, you can show that this example violates local consistency, which is one of the two ingredients we need to ensure spectral stability. So if you look at any site k that's far from the defect, so let's say, I don't know, the third site, if you look at the reduced density matrix that correspond to the global version of the code, it's going to be spanned as the 0 state and the 1 state. But if you look at what happens locally you only see those kind of projectors. So this local version is going to be spanned as 0, 1, and 2 state. Okay? And clearly, those two things don't have the same kernel. Okay? So you violate local consistency in this example. Okay? And so more generally, what we show is that whenever you reach a dead end, you're going to violate local consistency. Okay, we can make this argument very general. So it's essentially rewriting what I've done in the example, but in general. So you state the fact that whatever unitary that you put, you're going to be in the kernel of the local constraint. Now you take the average on that over the R measure. So averaging over applying a random unitary will depolarize site K. And now we're going to trace out the region that's on the right of site K, okay? And so that's going to tell you that there is something in the kernel of this object, trace over K of this projector. And now if you look at any state that is far from the site K, and you look at the local consistency criterion, this is going to be violated, okay? Because there's going to be something in the image of all the previous projectors, all the projectors that are nearby, but yet that is not in the kernel of the global projector, okay? So that entails violation of local consistency, and that's just the contrapositive of what we want. We have something that has local consistency, so if it has local consistency, it should always be possible to go forward, find a suitable unitary to go forward, okay? So now we know it's always possible to go forward. Second problem we need to deal with is, what's the expected number of trials? How many unitaries do I need to apply before being able to go forward? So we're going to introduce some maps to look at that question. So one map corresponds to successful measurement of the local constraint, failed measurement, and depolarizing of one site, which is essentially the average action of applying a random unitary. So if you think about what happens when I'm at site K, I do something at random on site K, essentially I depolarize site K, I do a measurement, it fails, I depolarize site K, I again do a failed measurement, and I do that repeatedly until at some point I have a successful measurement, okay? So I always have this kind of map. I depolarize site K, do a failed measurement, then depolarize site K, and so on, okay? So you can rewrite this thing to just be depolarizing site K and applying some biasing map on site K minus one, Okay, and now the idea is that doing this m times essentially boils down to depolarizing site k and applying this map n times on site k minus 1. Okay, so this is essentially what's written here. Okay, m field measurement means just putting this biasing map n times on site k minus 1. And now we can write down the expected number of trials by just taking this. Okay, this is the probability of failing m times. And that tells you if I failed m times, maybe I can do with m plus 1 trials. Okay, so and you're going to sum over that. That exactly the expected number of trials. And this is more or less a geometric sum. So now you can write this that way. Okay, so it's the trace of this local transformation on the site you started with. And since this is local, you could diagonalize it and it has like maximal eigenvalues. And this expected number of trials is going to be bounded by this maximum eigenvalue. And this is all local, so that cannot depend in any way with the size of the system. This only depends on the microscopic details of the local projectors that you have that define the code. Okay, so the expected number of trials is a constant independent of system size. Okay, so essentially that means that at each step, after a constant number of time, I'm going to be able to go forward. So after globally a number of time that grows linearly with the system size, it's possible for me to go from one end of the strip to the other end of the strip. Okay, so that's good. And now I need to show that I'm doing something non-trivial in the code. Okay, I haven't just found like some crazy way to apply the identity. So we're going to look at the average action of the iterative randomization model. And we're going to show that it's exactly the average action of the Fortuitous model, the one where I just depolarize everything and project back onto the code. So for that, you just look at the average effect of the iterative randomization model. So for one given iteration, you can write it that way again with this biasing map. And again, using the trick that this is a geometric sum, you can write it in this way. And then the average effect is just going to be multiplying all those maps for every iteration. So that has this form. And now you can play the trick of trying to rearrange the terms in that product. So first, all the depolarizing map which act on the right. So there's depolarizing map at site k. And then for the other term on the right of the product, they do not act on site k. So I can move all these depolarizing map to the right of my product. Okay, so that's one thing I can do. And afterwards, this biasing map and this successful projection, remember that the biasing map is essentially linked to doing failed measurement, okay? And this is linked to projectors that commute with one another. So you can show that you can also swap those terms around, okay? So you can reorder all the terms in this product to end up with something that is exactly this. So you have all the depolarizing maps on the right, biasing maps, and then projection back onto the code, okay? Yeah. So you depolarize, you apply some bias, and then you project back onto the code. So except for this term, this is precisely the average action of the map I showed in the Fortuitous model. You depolarize everything and then you project back onto the code. Okay. So and here what's a bit surprising is that you have this biasing map that might favor some ground state rather than others. Okay. But what's clear is that since you're depolarizing everything at the beginning, you're wiping out the information encoded in the strip, and at the end you're projecting back onto the code. Okay, so you've gone from one ground state to a different ground state, okay? And on average, you're doing something non-trivial, okay? So you're destroying the information encoded in the code. All right, so with that, so again, we have a physically realistic error model that corrupts the information for any 2D local topologically ordered code. Open problems, can we have a noise process that occurs in parallel rather than something sequential? So that's something we're looking at. I said local topological order is sufficient for spectral stability. Is it really necessary? If we could do away with it, we might escape this no-go result that relies on local consistency. We don't know what happens in a frustrated system. All here is true for frustration-free commuting projector systems. So what is does any of that extend to more general models? We don't know. This doesn't bode well for 2D self-correcting memories, but I want to argue there's still some hope, okay? One hope is that I'm not really satisfied with the notion of self-correction that I gave, okay? And in particular, we have a thermal environment, but somehow we have kind of like a like T equals zero model in the sense that we're not taking into account entropy at all. And we know that usually thermalization at finite temperature is going to minimize the free energy, okay? Or in other words, like we've shown that there's a sequence of local moves that corrupts the information, but is there only one? Is there many of them? Is the sequence probable or not? We haven't said anything about that. Okay, so somehow that would mean looking into this problem, and maybe there you might have a memory which is not protected by an energy barrier, but there would be some kind of entropy barrier in the sense that there's a sequence of local moves that the environment could apply to corrupt the information, but maybe there's only one, or it's very difficult for the environment to find it. So it would be difficult for the environment to apply it, so we'll get a long lifetime because of that. Okay, so that would be an entropy-protected memory. And now, if you are willing to go to 3D, then we know we have some examples of codes with a scalable energy barrier, namely Zhang Wenzha cubic code, which is a stabilizer code which has an energy barrier that goes as log L. And more recently, by welding codes, you can show other 3D code that have an even better scaling of the energy barrier. Okay. And with that, I'm going to thank you for your attention. Yes?
So in this open problem that you have, the second one, is local topological order necessary for spectral stability?
Yeah.
Why? How could it not be necessary?
Okay, so remember that local topological order is split into two criteria. The first one is the fact that you have no local order parameter. So this one, probably you need it.
Okay.
The second one, local consistency, you cannot totally do away with in the sense that you have models, explicit examples where you have TQO1, so the first criterion which is satisfied, yet you do not have a stable spectrum. Okay, so you need an additional ingredient. Local consistency is sufficient for that. Is it necessary? That's not okay. Yes.
Where in your proof do you use the fact that that the projectors are commuting? I mean,
in the error model, the fact that you only deal with terrible thing. So when you're at site K, you only do something on site K. And most of the time, the projection on the local constraint is going to fail. However, failing to have this local constraint satisfied does not affect whatever you've done on the previous site. It does not affect the local constraint that was in the previous sites. And that's linked to the fact that they can.
Yeah. I mean, we should talk because, I mean, so if you have any Hamiltonian,
yes,
you can imagine, and suppose it has, just for the moment, that it has a unique ground state.
Okay.
So you can imagine, you know, depolarizing k qubits of that ground state,
mm-hmm.
and then looking at the, suppose it's a sum of projectors,
yes.
non-commuting projectors.
Okay.
Then you can look at the map, which is, you know, measure the projector on that set of k qubits that you just depolarized.
Okay.
And if you get the correct thing, you're done. But if you don't, you just depolarize again, and so on. I mean, that's essentially
okay.
what you do here.
Yeah, okay.
And that map can be analyzed. I mean, we did.
Okay, well, if you have anything on the line, I'd be happy to talk about it. But my intuition is that you don't want to destroy whatever progress you've done before.
Right.
So that's where the assumption of commuting
sure.
comes into play. But if you have a way to do away with it, I'm happy to look at that.
Sure, yeah, we should.
Yeah. Other questions? Yes.
Any comments? So if you have a real Hamiltonian and you have some...
What do you mean by real?
Well, it has commuting term. It has not only projectors that commute, but only some other terms.
Okay, yes.
you know, that would sort of help you having stability fluctuations. Because, you know, you would sort of, it would be harder to do the sequential.
So the idea is to replace the projectors by just like local, by just more general linear operators, is that it?
Yeah.
Well, okay, so I agree with the beginning. I mean, in general, you would have an Hamiltonian which has generic linear operators. But since it's frustration free, and we're only interested in the ground space and the scaling of the energy, we can take any of those linear operator, which has like a bunch of eigenvalues, and only consider the projector onto its smallest eigenvalue, if you have a 90% largest eigenvalue. Okay. This is going to give us another like Hamiltonian, which is fits exactly into my class of codes, which has the exact same ground states, ground space, and the gap is just only going to be changed by an interpretative constant. So I mean, it's not going to change fundamentally the scaling of everything. So any frustration-free commutative term Hamiltonian can be put into that framework. If you're only interested in like the ground space and the scaling of the gap. I mean, if you want to have more details about energies and all that, I mean, you need more information, but this is kind of a coarse graining that you can. And that's due to the fact that you're frustration free. If you're not frustration free, then it becomes too like it's different.
Any questions? That's like Olivier.